Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Hi, welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Reddy, but my friends call me Spanners, so let's be friends. We've got a summer buffet over the next couple of weeks with two magazine-style shows, and midweek we're going to have a standalone tech show. Now, I've been mixing in the vegetables of tech into your lasagna of magazine shows for a while now, and this is the first one back, standalone show. I want to see if we're all big kids, happy to eat our veg. I want to see big download numbers for that tech show hosted by Matt Trumpet and, of course, all our expert tech news from Matthew Summerfield, a.k.a. Summers F1. But we've got a great lineup over these next two segment shows as well. We're going to hear from our friends over at Formula Nerds. We're going to catch up with Tomo F1. We're also going to be taking a look into IndyCar in this show with Tom Gaymore, which will be absolutely fantastic. We've got a real lawyer, Peter Wright from Digital Law UK, who's going to talk us through all the connotations of all that complex contract stuff that's been going on in F1 silly season. Bear in mind, this is being recorded on the Thursday, so any sensational things that happen on Friday and Saturday will completely ruin that segment. But hopefully, you'll get some good insight from Peter. But first, we're going to take a deep look into the past. Okay, so I am guilty as an F1 fan of only looking at things in my lifetime. I'm like the Sam Beckett in Quantum Leap, you know, where I only go from like 1980 to present day. But Jeff O'Boyle is here to help us look deep into the past. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Spanners. How are you doing?
Yeah, you weren't born at the time of our subject today either.
No, I'm a mere slip of a lad, just like you, but born a few years afterwards. But it's still, I think, still worth looking into this. And because it's difficult to find out exactly what did happen at the time, hopefully the numerous mistakes that I make in this segment will be glossed over and difficult to verify or otherwise.
No, absolutely hammer, Jeff, for any mistakes and historical inaccuracies in the YouTube comments. If nothing else, it's always great just to start a conversation like that. But first, I'll ask you, when I was on the Ringer podcast, there's a lot of new F1 fans there. And I say to them, you know, really, you guys are all but caught up on the sport now. And in a year, you'll know 99% of what old F1 fans know. You'll just lack a bit of historical context. And I feel that way about pre-kind of Prost, really. I'll often joke, well, before Prost, I don't care. But it's because I don't know. It doesn't mean anything to me. Why are you so obsessed with historic F1?
It probably goes back to my childhood. I grew up in a household that had a racing car in the driveway. My dad had my dad had a March Formula 2 car, which he used in hill climbs and sprints. So nice. It was quite a cool thing, a massive sort of huge wheels on the back. It looked like a proper racing car. Oh, yeah. It was, well, what I think a proper racing car should look like. It had a huge wing at the front, wing at the back, and a 2-liter turbocharged Cosworth engine in the back of it. So it was an absolute beast of a thing. And it, to my mind, I've watched Formula One, you know, since then, since I was a kid. But there's something about those huge cars in the 1970s with just brute force power in the back of them sliding everywhere. no AWS striking zone graphics. That's just pure racing. There's the, you know, the risk element of it as well. The tracks were a bit ropey at times, and it's just a wonderful area. Lots of variety in who could win as well at that time. You know, you'd have Brabham, Ferrari, Shadow, Hesketh, BRM, you know, the whole host of names that are gone now. And it was Emerson Fittipaldi's era with Hunt, Lauda, Andretti, Carlos Reutemann, Pache. You know, it was a great era for characters in the sport, and just pure racing. I absolutely love it.
Yeah, and obviously, before we go too rose-tinted, there was also probably a lower general driver standard on the grid. Reliability wasn't as much of a thing, but also, you know, you had 55 cars turn up and only the best 10 got to race or whatever. It was a very, very different sport. So the comparisons to modern F1, I think, always fall flat. As a TV spectacle, now I don't think it would sell, but at the time, and especially if I think of 80s Formula One, like, we didn't know any better. So the fact that the only graphic you got was the gap between, say, first and second, it didn't matter back then.
No, it didn't, because we didn't know what we didn't know, did we? It was it looked okay at the time. Yeah, it probably wouldn't sell these days, and certainly with the fatality rate and injury rate at the time, it wouldn't sell.
Yeah.
And there were things, it was a bit amateurish. There were driver disputes in 1970.
Oh good, we don't have any of those now.
Well, yeah, but the driver strikes. So in 1975, they rocked up at Barcelona and the drivers refused to go out because the barriers that had been erected around the track hadn't been bolted together.
So, oh, my God.
So it wasn't ideal. It was a little bit amateurish at times. You put drivers jumping teams midway through the season, stuff not being screwed on properly. They didn't, in the era that we're going to talk about, teams didn't practice pit stops at all. Ferrari were the only team that had the resources to actually do that because you didn't stop for tires unless it was wet and then became dry or vice versa. No such thing as intermediate tires either, which we'll come on to in one of the races we talk about. But it was a little bit like anyone with a few quid and a cigarette sponsor could have a crack at it. They might not qualify or pre-qualify, but it was an era where it was a little bit more enlightened in some ways, because even though, you know, the grid girls were in bikinis and all of that sort of bad historic stuff, there was a female Formula One driver who called Lena Lombardi in 1975, who was actually very well accomplished and a March factory driver. So, a bit forward thinking in one sense, but very, very backwards in another.
Well, we are looking backwards, and today we are focusing on the Hesketh Racing team, and that was the team, of course, featured in the movie Rush. So first off, how historically accurate was the representation of Hesketh Racing in the movie Rush?
Yeah, it's I think it's fairly accurate. To give you a bit of background, it was founded in 1972 by Lord Alexander Fairmore Hesketh at just 22 nice years old. At 22 years old, proving that all he needed was a little ambition and a large inheritance to start a Formula One team. But
what a plucky outsider. All you needed was a large inheritance.
He famously didn't want sponsorship on the car. He thought it was vulgar and ghastly. And when you've got, you know, quite a lot of cash in the bank, you might well think that, but that turned out in the end to be quite a costly decision for him. But the portrayal in Rush is that the Hesketh team were all party animals. It was champagne in the paddock. It was caviar. It was 125-foot yacht at Monaco that was rented for the team. All of that is absolutely true.
Oh, right.
But
okay.
What Rush possibly sort of glosses over a little bit, because in the movie, the main focus is 1976. And by that point, Hunt has gone to McLaren and Hesketh is no more in, well, it's sort of, we'll come on to it. It's not what it used to be. The team were actually really professional. Lord Hesketh would say that they were there to have fun, but they weren't there to be made fun of. So they, you know, they hired Harvey Postlethwaite to design their first F1 car, and he went on to have huge success at Ferrari and other teams. They had mechanics who, after 75, left and went to work for Hunt at McLaren. Others went to Ferrari. They had some really technically gifted people there. And all right, they built the car in its stables at Lord Heska's estate, and that's a bit weird, isn't it? But they did have the smallest budget in F1 and still managed to win an F1 race on merit, in 1975 at Zandvoort, which we'll come on to.
So that's with James Hunt. They started as a F2 team, but it was a little bit more fluid back then between F1, F2.
Yeah, a lot of the drivers would compete in both series. So if you look back even at Jackie Stewart's era, they would race Formula 2 and F1, and Colin Chapman was tragically killed in an F2 race when probably something on the Lotus broke. But they would race between them. So in 1972, they started with an F2 team. The driver was Bubbles Horsley, who later became the team manager, quite a flamboyant character in his own right. He, unlike many racing drivers, recognized his own limitations, and they put him in a Dassel Mark 9, terribly uncompetitive car. He said, that's it, I'm out of here, I'm not doing well enough, but I found your next driver. So a guy called James Hunt, who had a reputation for on-track incidents, as you might have seen in Rush, had been fired by the March Formula 3 team and was at a loose end. So he agreed to sign up and drive for the Formula 2 Hesketh team in its first season. And that car was interesting. It was a March 712. Hunt hadn't been paid any wages by Max Mosley, who ran the March team at that point. So in lieu of any wages, they loaned the team a one-year-old F2 car. Lord Hesketh bought two Cosworth BDA engines and off they went racing. And the one funny incident, the car was relatively competitive when it ran. But
in F2?
But like every car in the grid, it was unreliable. So they didn't finish too many races. But there was one race at Hockenheim, rather, where the car stopped, as it often did. The German crowd booed James Hunt as he got out of the car. So he retaliated with a Hitler salute. Oof. Which wasn't a great look, even back then when things were a little bit different. As you'd expect, the crowd reacted terribly badly to this.
Yes, I agree with that reaction.
the team had to flee to Frankfurt Airport and get out of the country quickly. So even then, you could see in F2, they weren't going to be a conventional sort of media savvy, media trained F2 team or F1 team.
So does that unit of Hesketh Racing in F2 with James Hunt as its number one driver or only driver?
Only driver. Only driver. One car team.
Yeah. Oh, okay. And then they just picked up and went, okay, well, let's try F1.
Yes. In 1973, they thought, this guy Hunt's pretty good. We think we know what we're doing here in Formula 2. Let's make this step up to Formula 3. So they bought another March. I seem to be saying March as if that's the only car. This podcast is brought to you by March Racing. They bought a 731, used it for two races.
Get your discount on March race cars by saying Apex. No, go on, sir.
they used it for two races, and then Harvey Postlethwaite moved to Hesketh and developed out the Hesketh 308, which was their first car. It's a good car. It was pretty competitive. It finished second in the US Grand Prix in 1973.
First season.
So they only entered eight races. The first one was Monaco, where James Hunt was running sixth in their debut before the engine failed. You'll hear a lot about that. He scored a point at their next race at the French Grand Prix, then fourth for the British Grand Prix, and second in the US Grand Prix. So it was good.
Just worth noting that at that time, you only scored points in the top six. So scoring a point in Grand Prix racing used to be like the holy grail for midfield teams.
Yeah, sixth and sometimes fifth, I think, in that era as well, depending on which year it was. So it was tough to get points. But they were buoyed by that performance in 1973 and had a good go at it in 1974, where they entered the full season. They only had eight races in 73. 74, first race of the season, Argentina, Hunt led, which was pretty impressive. But the car retired in 9 of the 15 races. So, yeah, to finish first, you must first finish. Yeah. He didn't finish too often. Wow. But when he did, he finished well. The car finished third three times. And it had a win in 1974, but it wasn't a championship race. There was a big race at the time called the BRDC International Trophy that was held at Silverstone every year. nearly every big F1 team entered the race. It was a full grid. It was a proper event. It just didn't stand for championship points.
Okay.
And in that race, Hunt put the car on pole by 1.7 seconds, which even then was pretty decent.
People complain about field spread these days. Just saying.
Well, they did get a good race in the end, despite the domination in qualifying, because his clutch slipped at the start, and when he was trying to find a gear, this is very 70s F1, the gear knob came away in his hand.
Of course it did.
So he's left in 14th place, not moving, with a stub instead of a gear stick. By half distance, he got up to second place. So he was flying through the field, got up behind Carlos Reutemann and overtook him with two wheels on the grass at 160 miles an hour through Woodcote. And people who were there at the time say it was one of the best overtakes of that era for anyone who
was he off track?
Track limits wasn't a thing back then. Mm. It's only two. It's great. If two wheels are on grass, you can keep the place.
Okay.
So yeah, that was their first win, was 1974. And they thought they'd really arrived at that point. They didn't win another race in 74 and didn't win any championship races, but three third places was still pretty impressive considering.
Yeah,
their budget at the time was around £300,000 for a season. Brabham were rumored to be spending maybe £600,000, maybe a bit more than that. They had sponsorship from Elf. It was a good outfit. McLaren had sponsorship from Marlborough. And then you've got Ferrari, who had a £5 million a year budget.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's a huge difference. So, again, people complaining about the budget cap not quite being right now, that's a massive difference. And when you think most of Hesketh's budget was going on lobsters and yachts as well as that, that's incredible.
Yeah, it was pretty impressive. They didn't have premises to pay for, I suppose, because the cars were built at the stables, which
just
were converted into
garage. Yeah.
Yeah, his massive, massive mansion, yeah. But it's still pretty impressive to spend $300,000 and beat the Ferraris on merit. I mean, 1975 was kind of is the season that's most interesting, I think, because of the win at Zandvoort. The 308 that Harvey Postlethwaite designed was really slippery, so low drag car. And it was the only car that the Ferraris couldn't just drive past. Ferrari had the 712T, which was a phenomenal piece of kit. Didn't start off all that well at the start. It was a little bit sort of middling in the first few races, but once they got it sorted out, it was so fast in a straight line that Lauda and Reutemann were practically unbeatable once they really got up and running. But they arrived in Zandvoort, Ferrari all lockout in the front row. So you got Lauda on pole, Reutemann in second. But the heavens had opened before the race started. So everyone starts on wets. As I said at the start, there's no inters in this period. You've got to pick a side, wets or dries or slicks. And in Monaco, Hunt had worked something out that none of the other teams seemed to. He'd worked out that if the track was rubbered up enough, even if it was wet, if you were on slicks, there was enough grip to be quick. Whenever it looked as if you only a mad person would stop and put slicks on. So in Monaco, he stopped on lap 7, I think it was, really early stop. But the pit stop was a disaster. As I said, they didn't practice pit stop. So it was always going to be a disaster. It was 20 seconds or 30 seconds longer than it should have been. He goes out. He's really fast, but he's way down the pack. And in the end, he crashes out on the outside racing against Depailler. Brilliant incident where he's on the outside. Definitely Hunt's fault, goes straight on into the barrier. And when the marshals come to try and get him off the track, he has a fight with one of the marshals, physically swings at him, refuses to leave a live racetrack so that on the next lap, when Depailler comes around again, he can actually, he just waves and shakes a fist at him.
There's got to be some footage of that.
There is. Yeah. It's in, if you look at if you've got F1 TV, a subscription, which if you're into historic racing is definitely well worth having. There's a season review from 75 with that clip in it, which is absolutely brilliant.
Look that up straight after this.
but the Hunt, obviously furious at his own mistake and happy to blame someone else, he had stumbled on something about this wet dry track and it being rubbered up. So when they get to Zandvoort, starts on wet and pits on lap 7 when the track's still really, really wet. By comparison, the Ferrari stopped on laps 13 and 14 and no one believed that Hunt had made the right call. It looked like it was far too early, and there was no TV footage of the race itself. The radio commentary at the track was in Dutch, so the teams didn't really know how anyone was doing. They could see a little bit of the cars going past on the pit straight, so they'd see two red ones and then a white one or whatever it might be. But whenever they, when Hunt came out on lap 14, sorry, when Lauda came back out in lap 14, they couldn't believe it. Hunt was leading. So he'd invented the undercut. It was an absolute strategic masterstroke to go on slicks on a track that was still very, very wet or fairly wet. And he was leading by a fair margin. You've got two red dots coming up behind him. Mm-hmm. And Lauda in particular, made really good ground and was all over his gearbox towards the end of the race. But that Hesketh being so slippery in a straight line, being so draggy, he couldn't find a way past. So Hunt won the race in the car with the smallest budget on merit against the all-conquering Ferrari. It was one of the great underdog races of
the year. It's like a perfect storm, really, having discovered that thing as well. Zandvoort isn't the biggest track anyway, and people, I guess, forget how much harder overtaking was in that time.
Yeah, it was tricky and dangerous. If you get it wrong, Zandvoort is tight and twisty anyway. But he put in the laps to get ahead, you know, and was ahead on merit on pace because he was on the right tires and willing to take risks, I suppose. But it was the race was so impressive that Enzo Ferrari invited Lord Hesketh to come and see him in Italy at Maranello, and he wanted to work on a collaboration because the Ferrari engine was all conquering. It was so fast, but their chassis development wasn't quite as good as it could have been. And they wanted to sort of team up and have a Ferrari-Hesketh collaboration, but Hesketh sort of turned it down. At that point, he wasn't quite bankrupt, so he probably didn't think he needed to. Yeah. And he was worried that they would put the English driver out and put an Italian in instead, and there'd be friction. It would all be very Italian.
But, it would all be very Italian. Okay, clipping that for a replay. All right. And you carry on.
So the risk that the team would become very Italian, a little bit acrimonious, a little bit sort of and other stereotypes are available. He turned it down.
But also there's that pride of wanting to continue to be a privateer outfit as well. You know, it's his team. It wouldn't be his team anymore if they collaborated, i.e. acquired.
Yeah, you'd lose the champagne. It would be mid-market Prosecco at best, wouldn't it? So in 75 they did carry on. The car was pretty unreliable, six retirements, but they did finish fourth in the championship, which for a team like Hesketh with one car alone was pretty impressive. And they had a couple of second places as well, no more wins, but really good. It was only, you know, you'd think at the end of 75 this is it, now we can springboard 76, we're really going to smash this. But unfortunately, there was a recession in the UK, much as we're about to have again today. And Lord Hesketh had a number of business interests. His inheritance didn't all go in Formula One. He invested in lots of other things as well. And in 1975, he was mainly in the business of losing money. So it was going down the pan really for him personally and financially. So there was a deadline of, November 1975. Each F1 team that intended to race the following year had to submit their details of their sponsor, and the sponsor had to bring at least £300,000 to the team. I think it was an attempt to try and weed out some of the real poor teams at the back of the grid that failed to qualify.
Sponsor could be a private sponsor, so it could be his own personal wealth.
Yeah, it could have been if he hadn't lost it. This is in the Rush movie where, you know, Hunt turns up and the car is, there the people walking out with boxes, and it's all the party's over, and then he moves to McLaren famously.
So how big a blow for Hesketh would that be to lose their superstar driver? I would imagine at that time, I feel like the driver probably made an awful lot more difference than it does now.
Yeah,
if he got a real star,
he would. He was a real talent, to lose him was a real blow, but Lord Hesketh wound the team up and he couldn't continue. And they were a real partnership, Hesketh and Hunt. They were as thick as thieves. And it was only, the team only carried on because Bubbles Horsley managed to sort of get the remnants of it together and create a new Hesketh team. But it was never the same. It was a bit of a disaster, a bit of a joke really, from 76 to finally wound up in 78. The financial position got steadily worse. The results were absolutely atrocious. And because of the flamboyant lifestyle, the only sponsors they could attract were Rizla and Penthouse.
Spot on.
For younger readers, for younger listeners, it was a gentleman's magazine back in the day.
And Rizla is a way to roll legal tobacco products into cigarettes.
only legal tobacco. Yeah. There are no illegal tobacco products, as far as I understand.
Yep. But we're saying the same thing.
When he was trying to secure sponsorship, Lord Hesketh spoke with two sponsors who were interested. One was Philip Morris, who makes legal cigarettes. And difficult to believe in the modern era, but actually the reason that Philip Morris cited as not investing in the team was that they were too well known. There were too many personalities attached to the team. Hunt was seen as being a bit of a ladies' man, as they would say back in the day. Probably be in a register if he was around today. But Philip Morris, the maker of cigarettes, felt that their reputation was too racy and it would detract from the good name of the Philip Morris cigarettes, which is, you know, remarkable to think of that these days, that celebrities were putting off a sponsor from getting involved. The other potential sponsor they spoke to was even worse. It was Parmalat, you know, the Italian giants. They'd offered 1.5 million up front, which would obviously have been more than enough to support the team. But Hesketh tells the story that the deal was you get 1.5 million, but you've got to give 750K back. And it was a money laundering scam.
Oh, so, okay.
Yeah, he didn't bother going down that route. And that was it. They were gone.
So they did have three post-Hunt, post-meaningful success years on the grid, you know, but were they, this was back in the days where you had to turn up and qualify. Like, did they at least have drivers? Did they get onto grids?
Yeah, sort of. 76, 77, they sort of qualified. They had a number of different drivers who would turn up, most of whom would just abandon them again. They had one good race in 78 with Derek Daly, who qualified and was actually dicing for the lead whenever Stone went through his visor and he had to retire. But that was the only race in 78 that they managed to qualify for. And after, I think it was six races or eight races in 78, the team just folded completely. So it was, yeah, they were no longer the plucky underdog who could win races and compete for podiums. They were just an underdog that was performing as an underdog would be expected to. It was poor.
Is he still knocking about? Is he, Lord Hesketh?
Lord Hesketh is still knocking about, as far as I know. He recorded a podcast with the Beyond the Grid podcast. Never heard of it. Yeah, me neither. But I understand he recorded one on that, and he's quite a colourful character and goes into some of this stuff in a bit more detail. But yeah, I don't think he regrets any of it, which is nice, I suppose, in one way, because although he came from a privileged background, he did lose the lot in 75 and managed to scrape his way back. But yeah, I think it's a great story. Overall.
It is, and there's loads of things to lament, obviously. We can look back with rose-tinted glasses. I genuinely believe the modern F1 product is a better product than what you had in the 70s and 80s and 90s, in fact. But, you know, talking about the drivers moving between series more, I've long wanted some fluidity. Obviously, I want bigger grids. I would like that. I would like the gap between the tiers to be closer, because really, F2 and F3 is just, increasingly, it's just rich kids coming through trying to get their F1 seat, whereas I'd like it if, like, oh, a driver, he's having a hard time in F1, but he's got a few races in F2 that gets him back on, and a team in F2 could pick up and go, let's try and qualify for F1. That would make it a bit more of a dream factory for me, a bit more of a European sport model. But the franchise model, I don't think is going anywhere.
No, it's not going anywhere. There's too much money invested in it by the franchise holders at the moment. But I would love to see that. And it would settle, well, it would help to settle some of the debates about, is the IndyCar driver really at the same level as an F1 driver? Well, let's find out. Let's stick a couple in and give them three or four races and see how they get on.
Yep.
Let's have a rotating IndyCar-sponsored F1 car where they give, you know, two drivers three races and another two drivers three races. You don't have this sort of McLaren model of having 15 IndyCar drivers all contracted and 10 Formula One drivers, and they're all expected to drive two cars next season. So it would be brilliant to see that. And do you remember the fuss that Alonso caused whenever he was allowed to race Indy 500 and he was allowed to race in Le Mans 24 and stuff like that? It was contractually, it was a really complex thing to arrange. And I can see the team's perspective. They don't want their prize asset bending it at Spa in a sports car and breaking both legs or whatever. But it would be so good to see it.
It would
be so lovely.
But it feels like the F1 drivers now are such celebrities and such superstars that they command that kind of wrapping cotton wool kind of approach. Whereas, you know, maybe it would be better if they were less kind of revered in that way and were a little bit more malleable and had to work their way through different types of contracts and maybe didn't, different kinds of series, and maybe didn't have to spend 50 days a year playing the how level can I keep this glass of milk in a sports car challenge, because the thirst for them being on TV is so high. But there's one of two things that could happen with the popularity of Formula One at the moment. Obviously, it could fizzle away, but the most likely is A, it sucks away all the attention from other motorsports, which if you look at the MotoGP figures at Silverstone, it didn't look very promising. Or we start getting it that there's so many motorsport enthusiasts that other series start building up with, you know, and maybe we can get the things we want out of Formula One that we're talking about here. Maybe we can get that from other series. And, you know, we do start watching Formula E because of other drivers that have come in and out of F1 and the junior series. Of course, Formula E would have to make an effort to tell us where on earth we're supposed to watch them. But, you know, we can dream, can't we, Jeff?
That's part of the charm of Formula E.
You have to find out where it is.
Yeah, if it's meant to be, you'll find it. You know, yeah. It's like Lord of the Rings. You're right. I think it's a shame in a sense that we have to look to other series to get what we want out of Formula One. Brad was talking about this recently on IndyCar, and he loves IndyCar primarily because it's almost a spec series. So any one of the teams could rock up and win, and the driver makes a huge difference. F1 less so. Obviously, it's more to do with the car and the engineers and the, you know, the aero time they've got and all of that. But I'd love to see a return to the. I know you're old enough to remember because you're incredibly old, but do you remember back in was it the 90s? They had the kart race every year at Bercy in Paris, where current and ex-Formula One drivers, mostly Formula One drivers, it was a bit like Race of Champions, but it was in 100cc carts around a track.
Nice.
And there was Senna and Prost.
Oh, yes, I do remember.
Gone.
Yes.
Yeah, it was amazing. Mm. It was brilliant to watch, and they took it so, so seriously because it was equal machinery.
Yeah.
And, you know,
reputations on the line and all sorts.
Reputations on the line, yeah. And Senna had to race in a different cart because he was sponsored by a different fuel manufacturer. He was Shell, I think, rather than Elf, who sponsored the event. So there you've got your first sort of driver contractual dispute. But something like that would be amazing. The Race of Champions is okay, but it's not quite the same thing. Mm. But yeah, let's have an IndyCar race in the UK and have four additional drivers from Formula One in it.
Well, you're going to want to stay tuned then, because later in this episode we are going to be speaking to Sky Sports commentator Tom Gaymore, and I'm going to try and get him to twist my arm and finally let me take the plunge and make me take the plunge into watching IndyCar, because I do keep meaning to.
You won't be disappointed. I think it's some really good racing. The tire compounds, there are two, red and black. So there's a prime strategy or an alternate strategy, and it's they usually converge somewhere towards the end as these things do. But the racing's really good. Some of the street circuits in the US are phenomenal. They're, you know, they still go to places like Long Beach and Mid Ohio and all of that. And the ovals, I can just about sit and watch it. I'll watch as much motor racing as my marriage can tolerate, but. The ovals, I kind of draw the line a little bit if I'm running out of credit.
I think, yes, that's good. That's a good point. Yeah, when you run out of spousal credit. But I do want to understand the tactics of oval racing more, having done a little bit of it on the sim. And when it's not a crash fest, it's really fascinating. Like, you lose touch with that lead pack. Obviously, you know, the use of the yellows liberally is quite interesting as well. But yeah, okay. But to say that, I'm not doing down modern Formula One. I will be clear. I think it is the best product at the moment that Formula One has put out. And thank you for taking us all the way into the past. You can follow Jeff on Twitter at Jeff O'Boyle 1. I want you to all go and follow him now. Not the original Jeff O'Boyle, Jeff O'Boyle 1.
Thanks, Spanners. Yeah, I got locked out of the original one, so I can't remember any passwords.
Oh,
so,
Jeff.
So that's good.
Oh, Jeff.
But no, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
And hope to see you at a karting event soon over here on the mainland.
Great. Thank you. Look forward to it.
Thanks for your time, Jeff O'Boyle. Now, next, we can't ignore the fact that there has been massive contract shenanigans over in the world of Formula One, the silly season took a massive turn when Sebastian Vettel decided he'd had enough of Formula One, and then immediately, having assured, allegedly, Alpine that he was staying with them, Fernando Alonso instantly declared betrayal and moved to Aston Martin. So, how do we unpick all that contract stuff? Why don't we bring in an eminent solicitor, a solicitor of the Supreme Court of England and Wales, no less, and the founder and managing director of Digital Law UK. It's Peter Wright. Peter, thank you so much for giving up some of your very, very expensive time to join us in the shed.
No, it's great to be back on, and great to be, you know, as a listener of Missed Apex, it's great to be able to also then be able to contribute a little bit on this, I suppose, slightly more niche subject, perhaps.
Yeah, because it all went very contracty and law-y, and I realise I don't know some of the very basics of everything that's been talked about. I don't know what an option is. I don't know any of the terms of the contract. I don't know what the court of contract arbitration is in F1. Hopefully you know most of those things, although we should be clear, it's not like you've had a spy microphone in the Alpine office.
No, so everything we're going to discuss is all from publicly available sources of information. You know, I'm not advising any of the people involved here. So it is literally just a matter of looking at those news articles, but hopefully being able to give people a little bit of an insight, given what I do in the day job, which is very often looking at contracts, wording, and what some of this stuff means, and what some of this terminology means as well, which I appreciate to the uninitiated can be a little bit of a foreign language. Think of it as a Formula One fan when you first come to the sport, and you've got no idea about all this stuff about engines and tyres,
vortices,
fuel setting, yeah. And all. Exactly. Yes. So let's see if I can hopefully shed a little bit of light on that for all of the listeners out there.
And it's good to have a friend like you, Peter. You know, occasionally we've had WhatsApps from you over the years, and especially when you first started doing stuff with us, of like, you might be breaking the law there. So thanks for keeping me out of jail, Peter.
Judicious use of the word allegedly. I noticed it proliferates more and more and more. So you're certainly getting used to it.
Oh, I hear your mild northern twang in my ear going allegedly every time something comes up, and I make sure we're covered. But look, let's see if we can dig into some of the basics. Like, okay, why do drivers have contracts? What's the nature of those contracts? It doesn't seem like they're worth a lot once people start changing their mind.
Well, yes and no. I think the important thing to bear in mind with these contracts is that they've evolved from probably what they were 30, 40 years ago in terms of, right, you're going to drive for us this year and this is what we're going to pay you, through to these massive commercial beasts now that contain everything from image rights to personal sponsorship to how many media days you'll be doing with the team, and, you know, agreeing to sort of how often you'll be in the factory and how often you'll be in the sim. All the way through to the things you'd expect to have in a contract in terms of how much leave you get, you know. But I think it's important to bear in mind, I mean, we keep seeing in Formula One at the moment that the teams are getting worn out with the number of races. That's the same with the drivers. So you can imagine that would be the subject of a lot of haggling, yeah, between driver and team in terms of, you know, obviously I'll be doing all the races, but media days and adding all that together is actually something you'd want to make sure is squared off. Don't forget, this was Lewis Hamilton's thing a few years ago. He actually said, I don't want to do that media day in London before British Grand Prix one year, because he said, I will be tired and exhausted before going to what for me is the biggest weekend of the year. And then what did he do? He went along to the race and won it. And you sort of stood back and thought, he might have had a point there, you know?
Yeah, but thankfully, you know, no one made a big fuss out of him not being there. So it was all fine. God, he did get a lot of abuse for not attending that day. But, I mean, when you then hear from, I know this is a bit off topic, but Daniel Ricciardo talking about the Australian Grand Prix actually being a nightmare for him because of the amount of extra press and media, you can start to get this picture of what it must be like to be a driver and just try and squeeze a little bit of time out for yourself. It might even be like, don't call me on certain days. Like, I am not contactable from this period of the summer to that period of the summer. But it does make you wonder what's the balance of power, would you guess, between the drivers and the teams these days?
It will vary depending on who the team is and who the driver is. So you can imagine that drivers just coming into the sport, ordinarily, and we'll come to this, ordinarily you'd expect the driver just coming into the sport is going to be desperate just to get a seat in, you know, what is the Elite Series, the World's Elite Series. There's only a very limited grid. You just want to get on there. And that's ordinarily what you see, and that's why you see drivers like Fernando Alonso starting off at Minardi 20 years ago. But as we're seeing now, we've got Oscar Piastri, who's actually turning around and saying, well, actually, you know, potentially I've got several options here, and I'm going to want to make sure that I can do what I want to do, not necessarily what the team that I've been associated with so far wants me to do.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay, so let's work backwards on this then. So the very end of the chain is Daniel Ricciardo, knowing that he's not wanted as a driver, but having a contract, and reportedly is now saying in whatever tribunal or discussions they have, give me 21 million and I'll walk out of this contract. But if I get another F1 drive, I'll give you back the 21 million. So, like, how does that work? Obviously, we're speculating, but he was in contract for next year. What leg did McLaren have to just replace him? Because after all, it is a meritocratic position, isn't it?
So this was the interesting thing. I read, again, on a publicly available article here, but apparently McLaren do not have a break clause in that contract.
What's a break clause?
So a break clause is when both parties might want to make sure, or one party might want to make sure, look, this could be a fixed-term contract for so many years, 3 years, but I want to walk away after two. At a very basic level, anyone out there who is renting a property, this should be the first thing you look for in your lease. So, you know, if you go and sign the lease with the landlord and you're working out how you're going to get the deposit together and when your move-in date's going to be, the actual really important thing is to look at that lease and see, well, how long does it run for? Yeah. And if I need to walk away from this, am I locked into some, you know, awful notice period, or does it just say no? This is a 3 year term, and you're stuck in it, mate. And
yeah,
you don't want to find that out at the point when you want to leave or break it. So
yeah,
that's a break clause.
Looking at this. Yeah. So I mean, it could be as simple.
And I'll
say,
yeah,
sorry, Pete.
What's in the news?
Sorry, Peter. We've got the lag suddenly
says,
increased.
Yeah, apparently, yeah, what it's to
carry on is fine.
No, so what it's saying, the news reports suggest that McLaren did not negotiate a clause that allowed them to say, we only want to have you as our driver for say two of those 3 years and be able to break that contract at some point. This is a rare situation. It doesn't normally happen. I think we have to also look at the context and say, I think it's rare for a driver to move teams. And on the face of it, certainly as far as we in the sport think, underperform in the way that Daniel Ricciardo has. And we don't know why that is the case either. And I think we have to be quite careful about thinking about that in terms of we don't know what it's like in the team. We don't know what there could be things in terms of support in there. Who knows? But for whatever reason, on the face of it, his much more less experienced teammate, who is not a race winner, let's not forget that, you know, that book, Lando Norris, has made him look distinctly ordinary. I thought it was interesting, indeed fascinating, on the Missed Apex quiz the other day when one of the questions was, who's won more races than Daniel Ricciardo? And you remember, wow, this guy is a multiple race winner. For a good few years, he was the coming man. He was the guy that everyone thought when Lewis finishes, it'll be him that starts cleaning up. And it simply hasn't happened.
Yeah, so he comes in under quite a well-paid contract, having already had his $40 million a year contract at Renault. So I guess there was kind of like an excitement and a buzz about bringing Daniel Ricciardo in. So they weren't thinking about divorce. You know, they were like newlyweds, not thinking that their marriage would ever, their love would never fade. But yet they found themselves 2 years in and wanting to break it. So presumably Daniel Ricciardo now holds basically all the cards. He can't force them to make him the driver, presumably, but he can force their hand on the money.
Exactly. And that this has happened before where teams have fallen out with drivers. There was one case about 10 years ago with Sauber when they were going through distinct financial problems. They had multiple drivers sort of signed up, but of course only two seats. And one of those drivers was saying, well, look, I still want to having a seat fitting, even though the team was like, there's no way we're actually going to put you in the car. It was all negotiated out, of course. I think it actually involved hearings in Melbourne to actually in the courts in Melbourne to try and sort that issue out. But in that instance, it was just a driver saying, look, you're taking away my Formula One career here, therefore you're going to want to be fairly compensated. And that is the exactly same situation we find here with Daniel turning around and saying, look, and this is a negotiation, he is therefore deliberately starting at a high figure. And it is therefore quite likely that that would potentially be reduced. It is also possible that, and it depends how good relations remain between both parties. I mean, you know, McLaren is a large organization with a lot of different options that it could potentially do. You know, if both parties are quite happy, it could be that we end up seeing him racing in another series for McLaren. It's just increasingly looking like it won't be in Formula One. I think we also have to bear in mind, though, that it was only, I think, about a month ago, if that, that on social media, Daniel issued that statement saying, well, I'm definitely doing my third year. Now it looks like in the background he was doing that because probably the tectonic plates were shifting and he probably got wind of the fact that these discussions were taking place.
Yeah, but and also Zach Brown was making statements saying, look, all we want for him is to be on pace with Lando Norris. And if he does that, he's staying with us. And that was quite recent. So that does kind of sound allegedly a bit like a lie, doesn't it?
It does. I think sometimes, though, it's important to bear in mind that we see comments like that. And I think those ones from Zach Brown, that they were amidst a sort of more general interview that he was giving. And that was just when the subject of his driver, who, you know, publicly we know from the statistics and the data that he has been underperforming. So that was just the public response, just to sort of say, yeah, you know, it was almost like confirming what the driver's been saying for the last 2 years, which is, I want to win. I want to do well. And I'm not happy with the results either. So really, it just chimed in with that. But in the current febrile atmosphere, obviously, I think it got magnified. I think also we need to just bear in mind here the fact that isn't it incredibly convenient that F1's gone on its summer break, and yet here we are with hot news to keep us all entertained. And that probably is not by accident, to be perfectly honest. Formula One has done this, and this isn't liberty. This is going back to the days of Bernie. You'd find that over the winter, there'd always be something that would happen to mean that people were still talking about driver changes or teams. And that's, you know, isn't it funny that, you know, Alonso's move was announced right at the end, you know, as we come up to the summer break, and then here we are. Having this discussion, it's keeping Formula One on the news pages, of course.
Ah, I don't mind it because I know I'm one of the people that wants people to click and listen to stuff, and it means I've got an excuse to have you on. The counter to that is it is also like a natural kind of break point. All right, get to the midway point of the season. Now let's think what we're doing about our futures. Let's announce our retirement. So I do find that situation fascinating. I should say that with Zac Brown, that I did say that allegedly and sounded a bit like, rather than accuse him directly of lying. But, you know, it was all very close. So what is clear that it's likely that Piastri was on their radar. And you go, well, Ricciardo's performances haven't justified them making good on that and keeping that third year or saying that he should stay on. But also the gap between Ricciardo and Lando Norris isn't what it appears to be. Like the gap that we're seeing this year and last year, that can't be the true representation of their difference in talent. There has to be another factor. Either the car fundamentally doesn't suit him, or at some point, which I think all Formula One teams do and should do, at some point they backed their winning horse and said, okay, at least development is going your way, if not strategy, parts, etc. So there's definitely like more to the story, which we could wildly speculate on, but not with a respected solicitor of the Supreme Court of England and Wales here. I think we stick to the facts, man. So going backwards from there, we've got Piastri making this really, really super bold statement going, I will not be driving for Alpine. No, they've got this completely wrong. All of that, you feel like all those statements were playing out for future legal battles. Like Alpine being like, yes, he is driving for us. Of course he is. He has been in our cradle. We, you know, we've changed his nappies. We've paid for all the talcum powder for his butt. And now he's going to drive for us. And then Piastri's statement wasn't the statement of a young man. That was a statement of his PR and legal team. So it felt like all of that was setting up for future litigation already. So they must have known these battles were coming up.
I think you're absolutely right. And I thought it was quite telling that I was actually reading Joe Saywood's column, also of this parish, and he made the point when that press release first came out that Alpine said, oh, yes, Oscar Piastri will be driving for us. There was no quote from the driver in the press yes. release. And ordinarily, there's some stuff that you know the driver didn't say, it, but there's something along the lines of, oh, yes, I'm really looking forward to driving there and challenge and winning and podiums. Isn't this going to be great next year?
Yeah, they approve the statement. Yeah.
Yes, there's some generic... And there wasn't even that which showed there's something not right here. And that's exactly what Joe said. And sure enough, we then got the social media from Piastri that followed. And it is also a good point that you make that, look, Alpine will have invested a not insignificant amount of resources in Piastri, not just in terms of money, probably in terms of coaching, in terms of support and help in the junior formula, in terms of opening doors, contacts in the sport. There's a lot that actually ends up being invested in these young driver programs.
Emotional investment, Peter. Emotional investment. Okay, that's probably not legally binding. But they are making a claim, aren't they? A specific claim.
Yes, exactly. And I think emotional investment, I think trust is the thing there as well. You might think that, look, if you're on our driver academy and we've brought you through, there might be an element of thinking, well, you know, I therefore, you know, it's almost sort of reciprocal there that you would at least honour the terms of the agreement that you've got. Now, that obviously we don't know what agreement is in place, and it could be that there is nothing in his existing agreement that talks about having a race seat. Or it says, you know, race seat in 2022, but it doesn't specify which team, which seems to be quite is one theory that's been floated out there. But for whatever reason, he's certainly felt confident that I can walk away from this agreement that he has with Alpine, and that he is going to be able to look at other options, and he certainly has been doing that.
Okay, so the term that kept coming up was that the option on Piastri ran out on the Sunday of the Hungarian Grand Prix, as did some kind of option with Alonso. And everyone just kept saying option, and it went on so long that I was too afraid to ask anyone what option meant.
Indeed. And an option is a sort of very often it's a sort of an adjunct to a contract. It isn't a contract that says, right, you're going to drive for us next year, but it might be something that says, we have the option to put you in our car next year. And these can go both ways. So, for example, a driver can have an option with a team. That means that, right, I could potentially have the option to go with you. It's not a drive, but it's the option that, yeah, we might well put you in a race seat. The driver can have the option with the team, or the team can have the option with the driver, which can lead to your 3-2 doesn't go situation potentially. So they're not contracts that say you're going to be in the car and this is your salary and you're going to do so many races and be a part of the team. Instead, it's something that says you could have the option to be in the team, which is nebulous. And therefore, you have to remember as well that this will still be a document that has been signed, which will have terms in it. And those terms could vary. And in this instance, it sounds like there was an element we understand from those publicly released comments that maybe they were time limited. It is sometimes the case that these things are time limited. It might be an option for 6 months or a year or 3 months. It would depend on the terminology within that option and within that agreement in terms of how long it lasts. And then, for example, it could be that it lapses on one side of one for one party, but not the other. So this comes down to the complexity of what's actually written down and been agreed to by the parties and what did they understand.
But how can the understanding be so different? Like, someone has had to have messed up the legal side of it, and with Alpine pulling on the emotional heartstrings of how, like, oh, we bottle fed you, it makes me feel that Piastri's in the kind of technically legally right. Alpine let some kind of deadline pass, and now they're trying to kind of take the moral high ground. If you had the contract, I don't think they would need all of this kind of emotional blackmail.
Well, here it also comes down to the what the parties have understood any agreement between them means, and also what their actions may have conveyed. So if you're Piastri and you're thinking, I have had an option that lasted until the summer break, and you've been looking at what Alpine have been doing to make sure to make good on that, to think, am I going to be in a race seat next year? And you might go, I mean, and we don't know how confidential the discussions with Alonso were. Indeed, we get the idea that Alpine were actively negotiating with Fernando Alonso up until the Hungarian Grand Prix, and even during the Hungarian Grand Prix, I think.
So on the team radio.
Well, indeed. If you're Piastri and you're sitting there thinking, well, hang on, we've got Ocon under a long-term deal. He's not going to be going anywhere. They're fluttering their eyelids at Fernando Alonso and making him want to stay. So what does that mean for me? Am I going to be farmed out to a team at the back of the grid, which we understand Williams might have been a possibility? Or, you know, this suddenly doesn't sound very good to me. So therefore, it doesn't look like I'm actually, you know, if he thought when he signed that option that that was an option to drive an Alpine, and then he thought going up to that race, this simply isn't going to happen. His legal team around him, his advisors, may be arguing that, look, Alpine's behaviour suggested that he wasn't going to get an Alpine seat. So therefore, we've started speaking to other parties, as we are entitled to do. And therefore, now, their interpretation will be the option has expired. Therefore, we're off. In. Thank you very much.
I mean, there's nothing stopping him having a chat with people about potential future work, is there, whilst you're under contract? But you would have had to have waited for whatever it was to expire. You could literally have done it at 1 minute past midnight and gone, all right, Zach, I'm in.
Potentially, but also it would depend, again, what was in the contractual agreements that were there. So it could be that when there is an underlying young driver scheme that he signed up to that says, while you are part of the Alpine young driver scheme, you do not go off talking to other competitors. We don't know. That could be in there. And in which case they'd be saying, hang on, you've clearly been negotiating with McLaren for weeks/months. So you're in breach of that. So that's why this suddenly starts to get quite messy.
Oh, my goodness. So it's not going to get resolved. Clearly, Alpine feel like they're owed some compensation now. I don't think they've given up on Piastri driving for them or being contracted for them. Ricciardo, we understand, has been officially told that he's not driving for McLaren, and then he's doing his negotiations. But one name that you mentioned in our pre-show WhatsApp chat was It's a name I've not heard in a long time, Peter, and I didn't think I'd hear it again. You said Briatore. Why?
So, Oscar Piastri's manager is Mark Webber, but when Mark Webber was in Formula One, his manager was one Flavio Briatore. And he used to be, of course, team principal at the Enstone team under its previous guise of Renault and yeah. also previously Benetton. He has a long history in the sport. Don't think we really have time to go into Crashgate. So for our new F1 fans, Google it, Crashgate 2009. Yeah. He was banned from the sport and banned from the paddock for that, because the idea of, you know, forcing one of your drivers to crash into a wall at high speed, there's certain sporting and ethical implications of those.
It was frowned upon.
Somewhat, but it was also frowned upon that then he was let back into the sport. And I think he's been on the grid at one of the races this year. Yeah, I think Martin Brundle doorstepped him. Martin Brundle formerly drove for Flavio Briatore when he was, Martin Brundle was at Benetton in 92 when Briatore was team manager. But the point is that this is a man who knows a lot of people and has a lot of fingers in toes and a lot of pies. I know that some team bosses actually used to say, we will not actually negotiate with Flavio Briatore and therefore we will never have any of his drivers. But, you know, that was sort of 10, 15 years ago. And as it is now, as I say, he's someone who has a big contact book. And it could be that this, and I couldn't help but think when I read all about this, this almost has sort of echoes of things that have happened with drivers associated with Briatore in the past. Take a look at the Michael Schumacher documentary on Netflix. Listen to interviews that both Eddie Jordan and Flavio Briatore have given within the last couple of years on what happened when Michael Schumacher came into the sport with Jordan at the Belgian Grand Prix 1991. And then, sure enough, in less than a week, he then, I think, turned up in a Benetton at the Italian Grand Prix.
Of course,
Eddie's talked about the negotiations that led to that. And it's that sort of practice that I almost felt I could see echoes off here with Alonso's move, Alonso being managed by Flavio Briatore as well.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. So hang on. We are. I didn't realize all the strings from the marionettes went up into the same gallery.
They did in the past. I mean, certainly Alonso was managed by Flavio Briatore. I presume he still is. But I stand to be corrected. So if for example, Joe turns around and says, no, that's not the case, he's now with someone else, then I get that. But certainly in the past, Alonso and Flavio Briatore were very close.
All right. Well, it's all coming together now. You could see we're getting into murky territory here, but the pace with which those decisions were made, let's say you'd had a little bit of forewarning that Alonso was going to make that shock decision and you had already made plans elsewhere, you would be armed and ready with statements to issue once Alpine obviously made that first initial press announcement. Because they did seem prepared. But well, now we're getting. I think you just nod and smile, Peter. I think you best keep your nose clean. But yeah, my goodness, what a picture you're painting, and also like what a mess. These are professional race teams, and they are not looking very professional at the moment.
Yeah, but this has happened before. I remember about 15 years ago, Jenson Button having a great season with what was BAR, the team that eventually became Braun and Mercedes.
Tell us this.
He ended up signing with, he's with BAR, then he signs a contract with Williams, then he decides he wants to stay with BAR. Lots of money ended up having to change hands. But these are the sorts of things that happen, not necessarily every year, but every few years you sometimes find that there are these, sometimes it's a tug of love over a driver these sorts of interests, particularly with competing teams, and that sometimes in this instance, well, I think it's the advisors around the drivers. So clearly around Piastri, they've decided, look, we think actually you're going to have a better option with McLaren as opposed to Alpine, which is interesting when you think Alpine is the manufacturer-funded team. Mm-mm. But then again, that's what took Daniel Ricciardo there a couple of years ago. And then, for whatever reasons, he decided, no, McLaren is better. I think that's quite an interesting context as well. Alpine must be getting quite frustrated with potentially losing talent and having it go to McLaren rather than staying with them at this point.
Oh, Peter Wright, thank you so much for your legal insight here. It's certainly better than us just guessing. But you are the, hang on, let me get your fancy title right, founder and managing director of Digital Law UK, not associated with Formula One, but you do other clever legal things.
Yes, so I do a lot of advice for companies when it comes to buying and selling goods online. So things like data protection, privacy, cybersecurity, e-commerce, or as we tend to very often call it, selling highly regulated goods and services in different jurisdictions. So we've got clients from the UK and Europe to Australia and America. Having founded the business 10 years ago, it's growing along quite nicely. So, similar in some ways to the way Mr. Apex, of course, from small beginnings as now. There was a wonderful stat you came out with. What is it? The largest independently owned
motorsport. Wow. I'm inviting people to challenge this, but I believe we're the most downloaded host-owned independent F1 podcast. It's a very niche category that we've funneled it down to, but I think all the podcasts that are more downloaded than us are, you know, organizations. The people that present and produce it aren't the owners of it, you know, so things like obviously great organizations such as Autosport and The Race, but you know, it's not a dude in a shed. So I'm thinking maybe we get the dude in a shed award, if there is one. But I'm glad that it's all going well at Digital Law UK. And I've got to leave you to go and do some solicitoring, because otherwise you start charging me.
That word means something very different in America.
Oh.
Solicitor means lawyer, not... When you see those signs in America that say, no solicitors, that means something very different.
Roger that. I think we'd best leave it there. Peter Wright, thanks so much for your time. Okay, and finally, this week, I am going to put myself under trial as a mono-motorsportist. I am very guilty of using my precious motorsport viewing time only for Formula One. I do try and click around. I've made efforts to watch Formula E, even though it feels at times that the organisation is actively stopping people from finding it. But when I've chanced upon it, I've enjoyed it and wished I watched it more. I even sat and watched some MotoGP with my boy the other day, one of only three people apparently to have done so. But there is a sport so close to us in F1 on the evolutionary tree that I feel bad that I've not watched it. So in order to help me get more into IndyCar, I have employed, firstly, our token American, Matt Two Rumpets. Hey, Matt.
Hey there, Spanners. Delighted you're finally going to take the plunge.
Maybe, but we also do have commentator extraordinaire and Sky Sports analyst for IndyCar, Tom Gaymore. Hello, Tom.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I feel like I'm actually in an IndyCar, because if you watch IndyCar, you'll know with the aero screen, it's been notoriously hot over the last few years. And with the summer heat wave that we've got here in London, upstairs here feels very much like a sauna or an IndyCar with that aero screen. But I don't have a cool suit to keep me cool.
No, but I am angry with you because you were late for this interview, but for a very good reason, Tom. Tell us what you're up to, because it looked like a very good cause.
Yeah, I really feel bad for being late. I'm normally prompt. I'm on time. But I was in London. It was warm in London as well. And I am an ambassador for something called Divert London, which is working with children and young adults in and around the criminal justice system. So young people that find themselves in or around police custody. And it's an early intervention program. It's about diversion. It's about hope and opportunity. A lot of young people growing up in London are growing up without that hope and opportunity. There's real social economic pressures. And these are wonderful young people who just need that right pathway, that hope and that opportunity. So as an ambassador, I support a wonderful team of people that are in there in the engine room working with these young people day in and day out. And also a team of people that are working on referral pathways, because the program's only as strong as the referral pathways. So if we can't create hope and opportunity for the young people, then it's a very difficult sell. So I was in Brixton today, Brixton Custody, where the program was born many moons ago. It's the brainchild of a young man who's not so young now, Jack Rowlands, and he won't mind the plug there.
We'll ask him.
That's what I've been doing. It's something that I got involved in about 8 years ago, and I've been passionate about ever since. It's very different to motorsport, and I think it's really important to sort of stretch your understanding and your knowledge base and be involved in other things.
Fine. I guess I'll forgive you. That is at Divert London, if you want to go and check that out on Twitter. But if you don't mind, Tom, I'm going to use you, not that it's your job, but I'm going to use you to try and convert me to Indy and to at least be checking out. Because obviously there's a lot of differences, spec series going on to ovals. But firstly, obviously on the Sky broadcast, it speaks to how much more commercialised American motorsport is, that they kind of need a team there to handle the American commercial breaks.
Yeah, well, there's no real world feed for IndyCar. So we take the international feed from NBC. And when you get the break buffer, the itinerary, it's sort of 17, 18, 19 breaks sometimes through the green flag running. And it's organized chaos for us here in Sky Sports HQ, because sometimes you get limited notifications into the counts, and or if there's action or an incident during a full course yellow, NBC will come back. So we try our best to make it look seamless and smooth, but it is a bit of a challenge. But it's needed, because otherwise we'd have just minutes and minutes of dead time. And if you add up all the commercial breaks, that adds up to about 60 minutes. I mean, I think last week with Nashville and the Thunder Clock and all the delays we had, I think we were on air for about 5 hours. So I must have done about 90 minutes of that by myself. So it's a hard gig sometimes, but it's a much needed gig. And judging by the feedback, you know, we do bring some good information to those fans that A, have followed IndyCar, but also that growing audience. The Indy 500 was super successful in this country. I think our viewing figures were very similar to what Sky get for the last day of the US Open, the golf. So that just shows you how positive IndyCar is as a product, and how well Sky F1 are doing in terms of bringing that to the viewers. So yeah, with the dead time, you just that would just be unacceptable. We had it for a bit, but now, you know, I'm glad to be in there footing the brakes. It's such a wonderful sport, and I'll try and sell it a bit more as you ask your questions.
Well, one thing I immediately want to know is what kind of information, aside from just, I assume, pictures from the international feed, what are they giving you to help you commentate when you're having to bounce back? I mean, that sounds just absolutely bananas to me to have to try and do that.
Yeah, it's very limited information. I mean, I actually have a page from Firestone, so I get all the data to see if people are on sticker reds or sticker blacks or the Wyoli tire that we had for Nashville, Tennessee. We'll get onto that. That's a green sidewall tire made from plant shrub in America.
Okay, I'm out already. What's going on here?
Tires. This could not be going better.
And it's called the Wyoli. So it sounds like something out of sort of a Coyote Roadrunner movie. But that was my insight into trying to get all scientific at the weekend. But I have limited information, so we got live timing, that kind of stuff. Obviously, I know some of the drivers. So Alexander Rossi spent time over here. I spent a lot of time with him. Colton Herter, you know, Callum Ilott. So it's Will Power. There's quite a few drivers that I connect with and speak to. And that gives me that sort of underpinning knowledge and the insight to try and explain. You know, part of my job is not just to sell the story of what's going on and the strategy, because IndyCar is very much about strategy. It's about explaining a lot of the intricacies that IndyCar has, and the push to pass and the tire strategies and fuel. You know, we've got refueling in IndyCar, and that adds a really interesting scenario and aspect of the strategy. And we've got three different types of courses: road course, street course, oval. So the drivers really have to test themselves across like a wide discipline of different environments.
Well, street courses are garbage, so let's skip those. But let's go on to the oval, because that's probably the biggest difference between showing some restraint there. That's the biggest difference between the two series, between F1 and IndyCar. Having occasionally done the odd oval on the sim, the strategy from a driving point of view with the draft and staying with the pack, it's fascinating, actually. And it's not quite as just going round in circles as it seems. Although I have noticed whenever I have caught an oval race, you know, you do need the old competition cautions to bunch it all back up. And we've actually manufactured that into our sim series, so I can kind of understand why they do it. It's such a different discipline. Do you think you can tempt F1 fans to go and enjoy an oval race?
Well, I think, you know, just from the spectacle, it's dangerous to start off with. Now, we're not here to see anyone get hurt or to promote danger. But, you know, IndyCar racing is very much where some of the other forms of motorsport were a couple of decades ago. If you get into an IndyCar and you haven't got the balance or you hit the wall hard, it's dangerous and you might hurt yourself. And so the drivers carry that sort of mindset and respect into IndyCar racing. They don't always push to the limit, because if they have a car that is loose, they always say your greatest friend at Indianapolis when your car's not right is the pit lane, because you just don't want to be out on the oval.
And just quit.
Speeds, yeah, 230 miles an hour to be doing those speeds. And you have two types of drivers, drivers that haven't hit the wall and drivers who have hit the wall. And when you have hit the wall, you have that respect, and it very much does slow you down. So there's a real, you know, side to IndyCar racing where there's a challenge, there's a mental challenge there, because it pushes the drivers to the max. Christian Lundgaard was talking about it at the end of the last race, because they're heading to an oval now. He's been really strong over the last few races on the street and road courses coming across from Europe from Formula 2. But the ovals, he's just starting to get his head around. And one of the biggest aspects is that mental aspect, the fact that it's fast and it's dangerous and it doesn't feel right. There's a squirrel going behind me. There you go.
Okay. That, out of context, that is going to sound weird, but let's keep that in.
That's the Beverly behind.
Okay, good.
But yeah, stars every week. But but you know, that side of things is one of the biggest aspects. The drivers actually getting their head around, keeping their foot in. And you don't really get that in other forms of motorsport now, with the way that the tracks are laid out. Daunting corners are no more daunting because they have the big tarmac runoffs. If you get it get it wrong, you can just open up the lock, keep your foot in, run off and run back on. You don't have to spend a session building up the confidence to hit Eau Rouge, of course, because you don't have the gravel tracks there. You just straight line it and get it right the next lap. There's no real consequence there. Whereas on the ovals, there's a huge consequence. And so I think that's the biggest aspect. And then obviously the strategy is a 500-mile race, 250 laps. And, you know, you're in that car for a long period of time. You've got to learn how to race. You've got to learn how to not compromise yourself. I mean, there's the famous J.R. Hildebrand when he crashed at the last corner because he just lost concentration, ran wide to pass a back marker and hit the wall coming out of turn four, and the rest is history. Dan Weldon won that race, of course. Dan Weldon won that race, yeah, I think he did. And so, you know, the trepidation is the big sell for me, I think.
Is there more of an appetite for the danger that side of the pond? Because I think in Europe we're sort of more and more like, we could take it or leave it, the danger. You know, you do as much runoff as you want, really. Is it more accepted in IndyCar?
I don't think like I said, IndyCar pushes very hard on the safety side of things. If you look at the aero screen, the car, and you also look at the safety crews and the full-time commitment that they have to bring in those safety crews around with the IndyCar series. You know, I always say safety in IndyCar is second to none. I mean, they're absolutely wonderful. So I don't think they sort of promote the trepidation and the danger, but it's just there. We see it in other events, the Isle of Man TT. We see it in motorcycle racing, you know, that there is an element of danger still in certain forms of IndyCar, and you can't eliminate that. And the ovals, I think, provide a massive challenge for the drivers that are coming across from Europe. I remember Alexander Rossi going over there. His first time ever in an IndyCar was a test around Phoenix, which is a super fast oval. And he just looked at me and he just said, wish me luck, you know, because you just don't know what to expect.
Well, hasn't Lewis Hamilton basically like made comments along the lines of like, no thanks, you know, like I wouldn't fancy that.
And you've seen it. Max Chilton didn't want to do the ovals, but stayed on the 500. Mike Conway, who's another driver who came over to Europe, had a lot of success with Dale Coyne, won at Long Beach. He backed out of the ovals because he had that big crash at Indianapolis where he broke both his legs, his feet, and various, you know, put it in the fence. And so, you know, you do see a lot of the drivers backing out of the ovals. And, you know, when drivers do that, there is an element of support from the drivers that are still committing to those oval programs because they know the issues and the dangers. You know, Marco Andretti's talked about that. It is a side of the sport where, you know, when you don't feel your head's in the game for the ovals, it's time to pack it up.
Well, doesn't that also kind of speak a little bit to just how different a discipline oval is from street or road racing or circuit racing?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a completely different discipline. Just the way you race, the way you set up the car, the way you manage the tools in the car as well. There's so much that goes into the way the driver can impact the car. So you've got roll bars that you can work, you've got the weight jacker that you can change, and they're doing that across a lap the whole time, whether or not they're in qualifying and in the race. So there's all of those things. You'll hear when they're doing a qualifying run at Indy, the spotter saying, work the tools, work the tools, work the tools, and just reminding the driver to keep on top of the tools, to make sure that you can keep the balance of the car there. And you only have that with experience. And it takes a long time to get in an IndyCar, feel comfortable with turning into turn one at Indianapolis, 230 miles an hour, and start working the tools. Because when you're from road course racing or Europe, that's totally alien. You've never done that. And as I said, when you add the trepidation, it takes ages to sort of build speed.
So if I'm an F1 fan, and I'm coming to watch, you have convinced me, I want to come see this spectacle.
That was easy. I won't be so easy. Go on.
No. You were always more difficult. At least. Wow. How do I track the strategy? How is this strategy different with the refueling? How does that impact it if I'm going to watch it and understand it? Like with Formula One, I know I have a pit window and I watch backwards and forwards and I can sort of get an idea of who's really racing who, even just from watching the main broadcast. How do I do that with IndyCar?
Yeah, I think with IndyCar, you have obviously the refueling across all the disciplines, the road, the street and the oval. Refueling in oval racing, you'll see people short fuel. You'll see people try and work to the front. You'll see people come off strategy. So they'll start with a lighter car and they'll do various different things, get in early, have a long middle stint, try and get clean air. So the alternate strategy is important. They will also get their lap back. If they go a lap down, if there's a full course yellow or cautions thrown, they'll get their lap back. If they're a lap down, that's really important. That brings you back into the game. So you can almost afford to take risks in the early stages of the race because you know that you can get your lap back or you can filter back to the front. I mean, if I look at take away the ovals. If I look at the last street race, Scott Dixon was last after 29 of the 80 laps. He pitted six times in those 80 laps and won the race. Second and third pitted twice. So he pitted six times, still won the race and was last almost halfway through it. Second and third pitted twice. And
can you follow that as a viewer, or does he suddenly just appear at the front? You're like, oh. Because that's what used to feel sort of happen in the F1 refueling, because you just didn't know.
And it was very difficult to follow. Mm. So you've got to watch the drivers on the alternate. And also, you don't know what's coming. So I always say it's a giant game of snakes and ladders. You'll land on a ladder, you'll land on a snake. So Scott McLaughlin landed on a snake twice. He did everything right. Team Penske were on it. His strategy was brilliant. But you can't control when cautions are going to fall and when people are going to crash their cars. And he was the wrong side of the pivotal cautions he was the wrong side of, and that was his snake, where Scott Dixon was pitting to repair his car, do all the different things at the beginning of the race, but he got his lap back, he, you know, was diligent, and then he just got lucky on two very important cautions, and he pitted the right side of one of those cautions that got him into the mix. And then once he was at the front, he's Scott Dixon, six-time champion, he's going to filter to the front. And he did well to hang on used tyres because they didn't change his tyres on the last stop.
To save time?
Save time and to keep his track position. And that was the magic there, not changing his tyres. So there's so much in the way of strategy and with the fueling and the tyres and that kind of thing. And if you look at how many times he can pit and still win the race, that just adds such a fascinating dynamic for me.
And just finally, because we don't want to keep you from your squirrels for too long, how much of a spec series? Because there's spec series and there's spec series. A, how spec is it? Is this spec series? And how much of a difference does that make to the viewing?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you've got a spec chassis, spec tyre, and you've got a spec engine. With the teams, they can do what they like to the dampers and the springs and various different things. And then you've got some of the bigger teams have obviously very, very good simulation software and can really flex their muscles, if you like. But that said, if you look at last year, Team Penske, powerhouse in the series with Chevrolet, went almost 10 races without winning a race. It was almost, or statistically, their worst start to a season ever. And you had a rookie, Alex Palou, rise to the top and steal the crown away from the regulars. And Will Power was languishing all the way down in those championship standings. He's now at the top. And I think Will Power's average finishing position is something like 6.1. I think Alex Palou, when he won the championship last year, his average finishing position was 5.6.
Oh, so you get a lot of different winners.
You get a lot of different winners. Yeah, we had nine different pole sitters already this year. So nine different drivers on pole. It's really, really difficult to convert. Scott McLaughlin was box office all weekend this weekend. Couldn't convert. So, it's a tough series. And when you do win, look at Alexander Rossi, went 3 years without winning a race. Now, if you look at his stock and also the stable that he's in, Andretti Autosport, that just shows you how challenging it is to get it done in IndyCar.
All right. Look, I'm tempted enough listening to the tactics and listening to the permutations. And I think the fact that, you know, it has some things that maybe F1 fans are looking for, which is a bit more of a spec series, different chances for different drivers and different teams to win. When should I next tune in? Am I in the middle of a season? And who should I support?
Yeah, so the next race is towards the end of August. It's actually one of the harder ones to watch because it's the only race of the year that's actually on at a sort of antisocial time. So I think it kicks off at 11 p.m. That's an evening race. But the vast majority of the races, IndyCar are clued into this for the European audience and also with NBC. The vast majority of the races kick off our time at around 8 p.m.
Sort
of 7 p.m. So just think, Sunday evening, you've watched your motorsport, your Formula One, this and that. It's either been a barnstormer or you're thinking that's...
Or it's been Monaco, yeah.
Yeah, that's, been watching grass grow. And then you come in and you're like, right, IndyCar, 8 p.m., Sunday night, nothing on TV. This is going to go off. And every single weekend, without fail, it's a spectacle. So please do tune in. And you've got Gateway left in terms of the oval at the end of the month. And then you go to Portland and Laguna Seca and Monterey. So Laguna Seca, the corkscrew, where you've got the biggest elevation change of any circuit anywhere around the world. Monterey County, the dust bowl that is the Laguna Seca. So, and anyone that's played computer games or what have you, they've always got Laguna Seca.
Yeah, it's great.
So those are the tracks. So please do tune in. You'll love it.
Obviously a bit awkward, Matt. Did he say Sunday 8 p.m.?
Yeah, we need to have a word with NBC about this.
Yeah, let's just shift it. That's when we stream, Tom.
Oh, is it?
Devastating. Oh.
There's always the build-up, so that's when our coverage starts. That's not the green flag. I mean, as anybody that's watching American sport knows, that entertainment underpins American sport, so you've got a lengthy build-up with all kinds of different things. The invocation, the command, everything.
Hey, look, we've got a maximum stream time of 1 hour, so if you can just get them to delay 1 hour, I think that we can make that work.
Well, you're good for Gateway. I think Gateway's the 28th of August, I think. Let me have a look. It is the 20th of August. There you go. So that's Gateway.
Fantastic. Hey, look, Tom Gaymore, thank you so much for giving us your time, taking time out from your squirrels and the fan that I know you're desperate to cut back on. Please go and follow Tom.
A little bit.
Go and follow Tom at Tom Gaymore and go and check out his ambassadorship at Divert London as well. I'm going to check out that IndyCar race as long as it starts an hour late. Thank you so much for your time and thanks for trying to convince us to go and jump on the IndyCar train. Well, that's all we've got for you this week. I hate to be that kind of YouTuber, but if you're listening on YouTube, please like and subscribe. And if you're an audio listener, make sure you're subscribed on your podcatcher of choice. And if you've got time to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, that helps us immeasurably. Also, do consider being a patron. The only reason we're here is because people have gone and subscribed to our Patreon at patreon.com/missedapex. I hope you enjoy the tech show. I wasn't lying earlier. I will be checking up on the download figures. I hope you're all going to eat your greens and eat your vegetables in the form of some tech news with Trumpets and Matthew Summerfield midweek. Next week, we're going to be catching up with YouTube sensation Tomo F1. We're going to catch up with our friends at Formula Nerds to find out what's going on in the Junior Series and why we should be a little bit more investigated. And we'll be talking about racing rules with my new friend Callum as well. But until next time, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex Podcast.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.